gerade auch für politisch Interessierte und soziale Bewegungen ein sehr interessantes Thema ist. Heute geht es hier um Marxism after Communism, was sich ja auch in die ganze Veranstaltungsreihe ein bisschen einpassen soll. Kurz zu Michael Burwell selbst. Er ist seit 1976 in Berkeley, Kalifornien, Professor für Soziologie. Ist mir vor allen Dingen bekannt aus der Arbeits- und Industriesoziologie. Vielleicht kennen einige von euch ihn auch vor allen Dingen daher. Und hat sich dort mit dem sogenannten Transformationsproblem beschäftigt. Also der Frage, wie denn die vom Unternehmen eingekaufte Arbeit, die ja erstmal nur Arbeit in Potenzial ist, sozusagen umgesetzt wird in real geleistete Arbeit, welche Kompromisse und welche Kämpfe dazwischen Arbeit und Kapital sozusagen stattfinden. Das bekannteste Buch aus dieser sogenannten Labor-Process-Debatte von Michael Burwell ist Manufacturing Consent, wobei ich nicht mal glaube, dass eine deutsche... Ist der German Translation? Ja, also ist meines Erachtens nicht jemals übersetzt worden. Wir machen das jetzt so, dass der Vortrag auf Englisch sein wird, so war es auch angekündigt. Das sollte euch aber nicht abschrecken, dann trotzdem eifrig mitzudiskutieren, egal wie ihr wollt. Also traut euch auch unperfektes Englisch zu sprechen. Und falls das nicht geht, dann sprecht ruhig Deutsch und wir versuchen das dann mit unserem unperfekten Englisch zu übersetzen. Viel mehr will ich gar nicht sagen, and we switch immediately into English language. And I'm very excited to give you my delivery, and it's your turn.
Thank you. Yes, so I am going to speak in English, I'm sorry. If anything is not clear, just stick up your hand or shout out. Let me sort of say a little bit about myself as to how I come to be giving a talk on Marxism after communism. And first I'd like to say that I'm delighted to be here, A, in Leipzig, but B, to be talking to a group of absolutely young people. I've been waiting for many years for people to be interested in Marxism in what was Eastern Europe. Actually, in the last year, I have given talks of a similar character in Romania and in Bulgaria, 2 years ago in Poland, and that's very difficult to give a talk like this in Poland still. But as you know better than I, Marxism is very discredited, and however, Marxism probably provides the best understanding of what has happened in the last 20 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So I'm going to try and give you an understanding of my understanding of Marxism after communism. I once gave a talk similar to this in St. Petersburg, and they always say not Marxism after communism, they said communism after Marxism. It's another way of thinking about this. Yeah. So perhaps I should begin by figuring out who are you? Are you students here? Students? Any students? Students? Don't be shy. It's not wrong to be a student. Hands up for students. And are there people here and organizations outside the university? Yeah?
I'm not
from here. You're an outside organizer? Is anybody else? Any other organizers, activists from outside the university? So,
I was involved with the Education Activist Network in England.
Education?
Activist Network in the UK.
Recently?
I think at time of prison, you may not ask who's activist.
Okay, all right, I'll be careful. So, the students, where are you? You're from everywhere? Any sociologists here by any chance? One, two sociologists, three sociologists, and economists, political scientists, natural scientists, what am I missing? Historians, historians, three, that's great. What am I missing?
Philosophy,
how could I forget philosophy and magic? Okay, philosophers. Okay, so from everywhere. All right. Yes, okay. All right, so I've asked you what you are. Now let me tell you who I am. A little bit more than what Peter said. Yes, I am a sociologist, but I do sociology in a strange way. I am what they call an ethnographer. So I work in factories, and I've worked in factories, or I've studied factories through what we call participant observation in Africa and Zambia. That's where I began in the copper industry, 1968 to 72, long before your parents were probably born. Anyway, 1968 to 72, I was in Africa, and then I was in Chicago. I think Peter referred to manufacturing consent. That was a study I did 1974-75. That was still long before you were born. And I produced a book called Manufacturing Consent. It was a Marxist analysis of the, as they used to call it, the labor process. And I was asking why people work as hard as they do. Why do they produce, in Marxist language, surplus value? How is it that they are persuaded, since they were not coerced, persuaded to produce surplus? And I had this idea of a hegemonic way of organizing production politics. Anyway, that was how I began my, so that was my PhD, and I was at a time when Marxism was very fashionable in, well, in the West, and in the, no, in the North and the South, all over the world, 1970s. And there was a big debate in Germany around the labor process, and in fact, in those days, I actually did visit Germany, West Germany as it was then. Anyway, after that, everybody said to me, well, Michael, or he was probably saying, well, Buraboy, yes, you've done an analysis of the way work is organized and the consciousness of the working class in South Chicago, and you say it's to do with capitalism. But we, conservative sociologists, they said, no, it's not capitalism, it's industrialism. Nothing to do with capitalism per se. And I said, no, it is capitalism, the way that work is organized. So we had this argument, and I said, I will show you it is capitalism by going to something called not capitalism. And so that was my beginning. You know, this is called Marx's expedition. This was the beginning of my expedition through what was then we might call the Soviet Empire. So I wanted to see how work was organized in Soviet and East European society. I wanted to know what it meant to be a worker in Eastern Europe or Central Europe or the Soviet Union. And to demonstrate that my experiences in South Chicago were indeed a function, a consequence of capitalism, and that you would have very different experiences in the Soviet orbit. Well, I was also another reason why I wanted to come to this part of the world, because, again, this is before you were born. 1980-81, we're creeping forward. 1980-81, anybody know what happened 1980-81 in this part of the world? Yes, sir. A gentleman who's probably slightly older.
Solidarnosc,
yes. The solidarity movement. This, to my mind and to other people's mind, was the first sustained working class radical, even socialist movement. the Polish, or the organization of the Polish working class from 1980 to 1981, August 1980 to December 13th, 1981. In December 13th, 1981, General Jaruzelski seized power and declared martial rule in Poland. That was the end of the Solidarity movement as such. It went underground. But this was an extraordinary mobilization of society in the name of and inspired by and propelled by the working class. And all eyes were on Poland. And for over a year. And so this inspired many people to think of why in state socialist societies, as is what I call them, you would get a socialist movement and in advanced capitalist ones you wouldn't. Well, that was the puzzle that actually took me to this part of the world. Now, I'm an academic, or I was and still am, and academics are always slow. They're always behind times. So by the time I had got permission to go to Poland, the Polish Solidarity movement was over. So always too late. Well, my friend Ivan Seledi, a very famous Hungarian sociologist, actually, he said to me, Michael, well, you can't go to Poland, why don't you come to Hungary? So that is what I did. So through the 1980s, somehow or other, I managed to get jobs in factories in Hungary. The first fact, and everybody said, no, this is going to be impossible. You know, why is it impossible? Because in state socialist societies, otherwise known as the workers' state, the biggest secret was what happens in the workplace. What it's like to be actually a worker. You mustn't study actually what it's like to be a worker. And certainly no foreigner, no, certainly nobody from the United States should be allowed to see how work is organized and the nature of working class life. Anyway, so everybody said, no, you'll never do this. Well, I started, as some people suggested, by working in the rural areas in a state farm in a champagne factory. A champagne factory. No better place to begin your working career than in a champagne factory. You may not survive it. There's a lot of drinking in a champagne factory. However, you don't drink champagne. No. It's like, you know, the Ford workers in the United States never bought their Ford cars. They knew how they were made. You don't drink the champagne. You either drink beer or you drink cognac. Cognac is necessary for making champagne, but it was in Hungary. Anyway, so I worked in a champagne factory. Then I worked in a little textile factory. Textile shop, small, on a cooperative farm. And then, so this was in 82. And then in 83, the summer of 83, I began to really enter the industrial workforce. I got a job in a factory that was very similar to the factory I worked in South Chicago. So, a dream comparison. In fact, it was a factory that produces the gearboxes for Icarus buses. A place called Csepelato. Hungary exported these Icarus buses all over the Soviet orbit. And I suspect, well, perhaps even the GDR. Yes. Does he have Icarus buses? Okay, perhaps he still do.
Don't think so.
All right. But anyway, so I was producing gearboxes there. And then, you know, I had one dream in my life. Was to, you know, I would go to this place in Hungary, Miskolc. It was an industrial center, and I would take the bus ride out. And in the valley, there was this steel mill.
Lenin Kohazati Mubek, Lenin Steelworks. Lenin Steelworks. Anyway, what happened was that my dream was to become a steel worker. I'm the only person in the world dreaming of going into a socialist steel mill. Because a steel worker was seen to be the essence of the socialist working class, fighting with nature, producing the foundations of an industrial order. Anyway, I managed 86, 87, and 88 to be working in all for about a year as a furnace man in a steel mill, the biggest one of the big steel mills. There were 17,000 workers there producing steel, sort of trying to produce steel.
Yeah.
So what's a furnace man in German? Do you know what a furnace man is? Furnace man, it's Stali Bar in Russian. That's Oberstar in Hungarian. German, it's the worker who was actually actually making the steel, with helmets and it's the heart of the steel production. No, nobody knows? Oh, this is a smith.
A smith?
No, not a smith. It's furnace man. It's the person, it's the worker who tends to produce steel. You have to have an enormous furnace.
Fine.
Yeah, something like that.
Abstich machen.
Abstechmachen. Okay. Abstechmachen. Okay. My German's improving every second. All right. Can't get worse. Yes. Anyway, so. All right. So there I was working in. So anyway, I was working there in 86, 87, 88. And you know what was so extraordinary? We were there working, but we had no idea as workers what was really happening in Hungary and Budapest. My friends were telling me that there was a political changes, there was a pluralization of politics, and of course in 1989, the whole thing came crashing down. And Hungary, of course, was actually one of the originating impulses to the collapse of the Soviet order in Eastern Europe. Yes, it certainly was. And became clear in the negotiations between the Hungarian government and the government in Moscow that Gorbachev was not going to bring in the army if Hungary made changes to its political order. Anyway, it was a chain reaction, and all of Eastern Europe, as you know, underwent the collapse of the Soviet order and the introduction of a new capitalist order. Yes. Now, I was very skeptical from the beginning about this capitalist order. In the beginning, now in the beginning, I thought that the collapse of the Soviet order in Eastern Europe would produce something like the Solidarity Movement, would produce not a state socialism, but a democratic socialism, a worker socialism. Ah, that was my dream. That was my illusion. It was very clear, very quickly, that the transition would not be to a democratic socialism, but it would be to a very extreme form of market capitalism. The assumption was state socialism didn't work. Clearly the West was producing things much more effectively. Capitalism is obviously the solution, and the quicker we make the transition, the better. In Russia at this time, Soviet Union at this time, in 1990, there was what was called the Shatalin Plan for the transition from state socialism to capitalism. That Shatalin plan said you'd make the transition in 500 days from communism to capitalism. That's what's called the Bolshevik transition, to capitalism, or the Stalinist transition to capitalism. Well, it was a disaster. What happened after 1989, I was there still in Hungary, but I thought, aha! Here's my first chance to go to the Soviet Union, become a worker in the Soviet Union. So I quickly went to the Soviet Union in 1991. The first time it was conceivable that I would be able to work in a factory in the Soviet Union. I managed to do so in a rubber factory at the beginning of 91, and then in May, June, July, I worked in a furniture factory in a place called Comey, doesn't matter where it is, near the Arctic Circle. That was July. What happened in August? August 91? Well, not quite. There's something very special. It's the picture in the middle here. Do you know what happened in August 1991? No reason you were not born then. Well, you were in nappies, as they say. Yes, 1991, Yeltsin, who had been fighting for the dissolution of the Soviet Union, as subject to a counter-coup, the military and other members of the apparatchiki staged an attempted counter-coup that would actually restore the Soviet Union as it was. This coup failed abysmally, and famously, Yeltsin was on his tank. I think it was August 19th, 1991. He stood on the tank celebrating the victory of, in a sense, of Russia versus the Soviet Union, of a market vision of the world versus a planned socialist vision of the world. And there he is on the tank. And it was, of course, it was not clear what would happen, whether the coup would or would not be successful. What is interesting is that you can see Yeltsin on the tank. Did you see the soldier there? He's got his head in his hands. And he's crying. He may be actually anticipating what this transition will mean for his and his family. Or it may be that he is just a very loyal Soviet citizen. But anyway, the tragedy unfolded. I actually, then my friend said to me, Michael, you are responsible for all the disasters in the world. After you left Africa, the Zambian copper industry disintegrated that you were studying because the price of copper fell. After you left Chicago, the entire South Chicago became a wasteland. Deindustrialization. Deunionization. Your fault, Michael. Then you go to Hungary, and within a few years of you working there, the whole thing falls apart. And then you go to Russia. It only took a few months for you to work in Russia, and the Soviet Union falls apart. And they said, you're going to be put in prison camp, labor camp. So I was sent by my friends to follow the tragic decline of the post-Soviet Russian economy from 1991 to 2002. When I got so depressed that I decided to abandon the project. For 10 years, I watched the steady decline of an economy, the steady decline, the likes of which we have never seen in the 20th century in peacetime. Yes, the transition to a market was a disaster for the mass, for the majority of the people in post-Soviet Russia. Now, you see, 1989, this is supposed to be a picture of Leipzig. I believe it is. Because, of course, I don't know if you know that in October 1989, there were huge demonstrations here that were actually precipitated the end of the Honecker regime and the fall of the wall. The wall came down in November 1989. And so it's very fitting, I suppose, that I should be talking about Marxism after communism here. Anyway, that is supposedly, is that recognizable?
No.
See, what's happened in 20 years? You can't even recognize your own city anymore.
It's a bit dark.
Now, do people talk about what happened in 1989?
Yeah.
So this is, so at least the story resonates, if not the picture.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's part of the marketing concept of Leipzig.
Yeah.
Really? This particular protest, or just
The idea of like the city of like what they call like a peaceful revolution. So it's like they attract tourists.
So I'm enhancing the marketing project of Leipzig. Let's move on quickly then. So, all right. That is to tell you a little bit about who I am and, you know, and why I might be interested in Marxism after communism. Because I thought that this transition from state socialism to capitalism to a market, an intense market capitalism, would require and would call for Marxist analysis. And I've been waiting for many years for Marxism to reappear in this part of the world. Anyway, so let me tell you how I think about Marxism after communism in the light of this short history I have given you. So are there any questions? I mean, that's so far so good. It'll get more controversial.
Always talking about Marxism is controversial. Well, look, the first response is, communism is dead. The Soviet Union collapsed. Marxism is therefore dead.
There are many people who argue, and still argue, that Marxism was so closely identified with the Soviet Union, with Marxist-Leninism, that after communism, there can be no Marxism. Marxism is dead, Marxism is a desert, and effectively, Marxism has always been an ideology that justified this totalitarian regime. So that is one response. Marxism is desert. Nothing left. It's gone with the Soviet Union. The second argument is the complete opposite. The second argument is that once the Soviet Union disappears, if anything, Marxism will be liberated. There will be no Marxist-Leninism. But essentially, the second argument is that Marxism had nothing to do with the Soviet Union. There are Marxists, my friend, who's actually going to be here in Vienna, Eric Olin Wright, a very famous Marxist sociologist in the United States. He says, well, the Soviet Union had nothing to do with socialism. It was a form of statism. And therefore, you know, Marxist-Leninism was not a science. We should never take it seriously. And Marxism will go on its merry way as a science, irrespective of what happens in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. This is basically, in my view, the Marxists who sit in a greenhouse and building Marxism as a science in the laboratory, insulated from the world, as though the world out there really does not impact upon it. What is called in the West, analytical Marxism. Marxism is in a greenhouse. And so we basically say that the Soviet Union was a form of statism and had no relationship to socialism. I shall tell you now that I believe that we have to study the Soviet Union as an experiment in socialism, and we have to learn from that historical experiment. The greatest, you know, you might say, experiment of the 20th century. We cannot just repress it. So I'm not very enthusiastic about either of these two perspectives, that Marxism dies or Marxism was unaffected. There is a third perspective. By the way, American sociologists only think in terms of fours. So that's why I got four. So another idea is that Marxism is a tradition. It's a very healthy tradition in the sense that it generated all sorts of interesting ideas about the world. And it's like an old mine, and we can sort of search for the jewels, for the diamonds, of the history of Marxism, search for some of the truths. It's like an archive of interesting ideas, and you take them, like you go into a supermarket, and you pick off the shelves whatever you like, Only actually, in this case, you don't pay any money when you leave. You just pick out the best ideas. All right, that's the third view of Marxism after communism. And the fourth view is the one that I embrace. Marxism is a beautiful tree, an ever-growing redwood tree. And this is the idea of Marxism as a tradition that has roots in the writings of Marx and Engels, has a trunk that stems from the writings of Marx and Engels, and then has branches that develop and advance in different places in different parts of the world according to specific problems. That you get different Marxisms in different historical periods in different places. And in this tree-like perspective, the question is, where are we now in this tree? And I will talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. So this is the idea of Marxism as tradition. The Marxist tree. A growing, you might say, a growing program of research, a scientific project, which is at the same time affected by historical circumstances. It has an internal history and an external history. Yeah. Well, let me construct the tree. That's another way of putting the same thing. That basically there is these two dimensions. Marxism as ideology and Marxism as archive suggests that Marxism is dead. Marxism as living theory, where we have on the one hand the analytical Marxism that basically goes on as if there is not a world outside. It's a very scientificistic view of Marxism on the one side, and on the other side we have the idea of a living theory as a tradition that's very much rooted in the historical context of its production. That it traces its origins to the writings of Marx and Engels, but elaborates those writings in different ways in different places. Okay. The tree. Well, there we go. Trees have roots. For my vision, and these visions of the tree will change over time, from my view, at this point in history, I think there are four roots of Marxism as a tradition, historical tradition. The first root you'll find in the German ideology, the four premises of all history. Now, what do I assume about your knowledge of Marxism? Do people read the German ideology? Is that it? Yeah? Well, if you read the beginning of the German ideology, you say, yes, the four premises of all history. You know, men and women, if there's to be history, men and women have to transform nature. They have to enter into social relations as they transform nature. They have to procreate, and one need leads to another need. Those are the four premises. The one need leads to another need is what gives a dynamic to history, and very controversial premise. But anyway, you should let theorists have their premises, otherwise they'll never build their tree. So, you know, anyway, those are the premises. That is one foundation of the materialist foundation of the writings of Marx and Engels. Second is the manuscripts, the Paris manuscripts. You know, where he talks about alienation. Wonderful. That's often the most inspiring, for many people, the most inspiring part of Marx, the manuscripts, the story of alienation. The ways in which the organization of work under capitalism denies people their potentiality, denies them their possibilities, denies them their species being, yes. That's the second root, you might say. And the third root is, I don't know, Theses on Feuerbach, 11 Theses on Feuerbach, where Marx talks about the intimate connection of relations in theory and practice. Perhaps most popularly known in the 11th thesis, but nevertheless very profoundly presented in all the 11 theses, the close relationship between theory and practice. And the fourth
And the fourth root, I would say, is...
Oh, it's the preface to the contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, where Marx summarizes himself the ideas of historical materialism as history as a series of succession of modes of production, moving from the tribal to the ancient to the feudal to the capitalist, and boom, bug, Jericho, communism. So it's this linear view of history, and in which the inevitable outcome is communism. Brilliant, brilliant stuff. Anyway, those are the roots. So, on the roots we have a trunk, a tree trunk. Okay. And that are the three volumes of Capital. Apparently you began this project here by reading Capital. And that is often what happens. And the volume one of Capital is an extraordinarily unique piece of literature and brilliant analysis of capitalism that sustains its validity today in very profound ways. Anyway, that is the theory of capitalism. Marx didn't have a theory of feudalism, didn't have a theory of the ancient mode of production. He had one theory, it was a theory of capitalism, but it was a very special theory because it was a theory of the rise and the inevitable fall of capitalism. And it was a brilliant analysis of the dynamics of capitalism. That as capitalists competed with one another, they inevitably led to the impoverishment of the working class and the enrichment and concentration of capital, which led to two things, class struggle and crises of overproduction. They coincided in time and woof! As a result, finally, we make the transition from capitalism to communism. I think it's a brilliant theory. Unfortunately, not quite right, but doesn't matter. It really captured what was going on, in my view, in the 19th century. What was not quite right is that Marx didn't anticipate that the end of competitive capitalism was not the end of all capitalism. That competitive capitalism gave rise to a new form of capitalism called organized capitalism, monopoly capitalism, imperialism. Different people call it by different names, but it's a new stage of capitalism. And that Marx did not anticipate, I don't believe. So anyway, there is the tree trunk. Now, out of the tree trunk come the branches.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Sorry, I forgot about those two characters. These are the political writings of Marx. The political writings of Marx. 18 Brumaire, Class Struggles in France, where he recognizes the plurality of classes and how they are organized politically and how there is autonomy of the political, relative autonomy of the political from the economic. And you could also include his wonderful account of the Civil War in France and the Paris Commune, which inspired so many other Marxists, not least Lenin.
Yes, indeed.
All right, now the branch, German Marxism. Well, this was the great Marxism of the period 1890 to 1920. And I'm glad to hear that you are being funded by the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. She was the, in my view, the greatest of these German Marxists. So there was a debate, you know, between Kautsky and Luxemburg and Bernstein. And the issue was, well, in Germany, it seemed that capitalism was adapting to crises. The trade unions were becoming more and more reformist. That was the problem that German Marxism had to grapple with. And they had different answers. Kautsky said, oh, we've got to wait for the contradictions to develop. We've got to wait. We've got to be patient. Okay, patient. Luxemburg says, no, we can't be patient. In fact, the crisis is here. And she writes the accumulation of capital to demonstrate that the crisis of capitalism is here and now. And she argues that we must organize the working class now. If we don't, then we will face barbarism in the future, socialism or barbarism. And Bernstein says, oh, don't worry, capitalism will naturally evolve into socialism without us doing anything. Yes. All right. So there is a debate going on there amongst, of course, others too, I debate how to respond to a particular historical conjuncture on the foundations of Marxism.
Yep.
And then there was this Russian Marxism, facing a very different challenge, right? Russia is 90% peasant. You know, had industrial working class revolutions in a peasant society. So what on earth could Russian Marxism mean? Well, it would mean, in a sense, if you're really orthodox, the orthodox is that you must turn Russia into a capitalist society, move from this sort of semi-feudal to capitalism. Only then can you have a revolution, the argument was. But history took over the situation, and basically Russia, 1905 and then 1917, was facing all sorts of crises as a result of its position in the world system, fighting wars with different countries, and essentially the old regime, the Tsarist regime, was under pressure, disintegrating, and Lenin gets, in April 1917, gets off the train, he's been in hiding in Switzerland, he gets off the train, he says, forward to the revolution! And nobody can believe the guy. No revolution, they go, no, there can be no. He says, yes, we've got to do it. And he writes two very famous pieces about this. One is on imperialism, one is state and revolution. And basically he's arguing that there's crises in the West, economic crisis, political crisis, and we must actually be that trigger that will lead to a world revolution. Revolution in Russia will trigger revolutions in the West, particularly Germany. And then, when socialists achieve power in Germany, they'll come to the support of the Russian Revolution. That needs a lot of support because, as Lenin knows, it's based on the relatively undeveloped forces of production. Yes, now let's see. When do I finish?
Maybe
10 minutes?
8 o'clock.
Oh, I've already passed 8 o'clock.
Oh.
10 minutes? All right. So, yeah, I'm giving you a lot of history. This is the problem of not knowing exactly my audience here. But anyway, all right, I'm continuing with this exciting story. So, essentially, what happens is that there is no revolution in the West, and Soviet Union has to go it alone. There's a big debate between Trotsky and Stalin, and basically what happens is Stalin wins, and he says we should build socialism in one country, and the Marxism that develops is a Marxist-Leninism, which is the ideology which actually justifies what is a class society, and there are big arguments of what the classes are, but one can talk about the nomenklatura, the elite party state apparatus dominating the working class. This is not a dictatorship of the working class, but a dictatorship over the working class. So, Marxism becomes an ideology justifying class domination, something called Soviet Marxism, Marxism-Leninism. All right. So, yes. Well, you see how I've drawn it? It's degenerate. It doesn't develop. When Marxism becomes an ideology of domination, it loses its capacity to develop, its scientificity, and its capacity to adapt to different circumstances. It is a degenerate branch. And then we have Western Marxism, which is a response to, on the one hand, German Marxism, but particularly to Soviet Marxism. Western Marxism is a questioning of why the revolution took place in Russia and not in Germany, not in the West. What happened to that working class? Why did it fall asleep, as some Marxists would say? So Western Marxism is trying to understand the forms of domination and the forms of capitalism that pacify rather than generate a working, revolutionary working class. And, you know, Germany was, of course, very prominently in the Western Marxism, not least the Frankfurt School. And, of course, Western Marxism today, well, Habermas has probably left Marxism behind by now, but, you know, he was associated with the sort of latter day, in the 1960s and 70s, with a form of Marxism, was trying to grapple with questions of the potentiality of transforming capitalism. And Gramsci and Lukács perhaps are the most, well, among the most original figures in this Western Marxism. And Gramsci, for my money, is the most innovative and the most interesting, and we could talk about him later if you wish. But anyway, the story is, this was a response that's basically, on the one hand, a critique of Soviet Union as not essentially socialist, or missing certain key features of socialism on the one side, and also asking, why no revolution in the West? And that Western Marxism also contained, in my periodization, and a development of third world Marxism, associated, you might think, in China with Mao, in Africa with Franz Fanon, and a whole series of Marxists in Latin America. Also trying to figure out in this world conjuncture after the Second World War how one may think about a transition to socialism and what socialism might mean. Ah, that's my third world Marxism. So in a sense, saying that the Western Marxism was really all about Europe, we now need to develop our own distinctive third world Marxism. And finally, the question is, what's next? Well, well, well. I suppose that's what you've come to hear about. Yes. Okay, first of all, what? You know, we're going to get rid of this degenerate branch. And that, but we mustn't get rid of it. We mustn't get rid of it. We must, in order to figure out what those question marks is, what marks them today, we have to actually restore it. We have to think about what went wrong, what happened in this part of the world, and what happened in the Soviet Union. We cannot, the Marxism of the day, in my view, cannot emancipate itself from Marxism-Leninism unless it also studies the historical conditions of the production of Marxism-Leninism. We have to be studying the 70 years of the Soviet Union and the experiences, the very diverse experiences of the countries of Eastern Europe that were under the oppression of the Soviet Union. Okay, still we got question marks up there. You want to know what it is? It's called sociological Marxism. And what is sociological Marxism? And I've only got 5 minutes to tell you and we can discuss it more. This is a pity. You know, I was going to give you a picture of the development of capitalism in three waves. Basically, there's an 18th century beginning of capitalism. There's another wave of the expansion of capitalism in the 19th. It's the 18th. I might as well put it up. This is the man who, this is the picture. And basically, that is how I see, and there are other visions. There are three waves of capitalism. And what we see in the marketization, and I'm going to use marketization as the sort of measure of, index of these waves. Marketization increases from the end of the 18th century, and we're talking about Europe here, and then there is a reaction, a counter-movement. It is a labor movement. It is the movement that Marx effectively is theorizing until World War I. And then we have another wave of the expansion of the market until the middle 1930s, and then you get a counter-movement. In this case, it is a counter-movement that is organized at the level of the state rather than at the level of movements. And we get fascism, we get Stalinism, we get social democracy, we get New Deal. These are new forms of regulating the market. And then, so that goes from 1933 to the crisis of 1974, and now we are in the middle, somewhere in the wave, the what I call third wave marketization. We are always thinking that there will be a counter-movement, but any movement against it seems to only intensify that third wave marketization, and I believe that we're heading for, and I'm not the only one, some sort of ecological catastrophe. And the big question is, can there be a counter movement to this third wave? This is the context within which I believe we have to think about
we have to think about Marxism today. So very briefly, what I would argue is that the counter-movement in the first period was local around labor rights. The counter-movement in the second period was national state-driven around social rights. And today, I think we have to think about a movement against the market that is of a global character. It'll also be local and national, but it has to be global. The only way we can deal with financial capital and the impending ecological catastrophe will be to think globally and to defend, in a sense, not just labor rights, not just social rights, but also human rights, the very rights of humanity to exist in community, which is being heavily threatened. Contradictions are very different in the three periods: capital labor, production exchange, production environment. And then we have different debates in these different waves. This is the theory of history. You know, the big debate really in the first wave is, where are we on this graph? Are we near the final crisis of capitalism or are we not? In the second period, in the second wave, the debates within Marxism were around state regulation. Can you have socialism in one country? Can you have a plan? Can it be organized without the market? And what is the character of the meaning of dictatorship? And what's the relationship to democracy? These were the big debates of the second wave Marxism's responding to the second wave marketization. And in this period now, what I'm suggesting is that this... Oops. Oh, I jumped one, didn't I? Well, let me just go back. I'm sorry. The socialism and Marxism. In the first period, socialism had a utopian character. Marx was very reluctant to really spell out the meaning of socialism or communism. Basically, the capitalist economy will collapse and the working class will decide how to organize socialism. In the second wave, it was a very different vision of socialism. It was impelled by the realities of the Russian Revolution. You get a state socialism state became a really practical project to build socialism on Earth. It was not a utopian project, it was a very real, coercive project. And in the third wave, what I'm suggesting is that it is not a matter of a socialism constructed on the foundations of the collapse of the economy. It is not a socialism that is state-driven. So it's not economic, it's not state-based, but it's society-based. And here I invoke, of course, the ideas of Gramsci and his ideas of civil society. What is distinctive about advanced capitalism is the growth of civil society, and that we have to bring back the idea of social in socialism, hence the idea of a societal socialism and a sociological Marxism. Because sociology has actually built its own edifice on the basis of, from the standpoint of civil society, it has a long tradition of opposing market fundamentalism, whether it's a left-wing or right-wing sociology. So I think that Marxism today should be infused increasingly with sociological ideas. And Gramsci, Antonio Gramsci, was of course somebody who did precisely that. And then, as I was saying before, there are these different debates in the different periods. I think today we have abandoned, and this is part of the sociological Marxism, we have abandoned the idea of the inevitable collapse of capitalism. We have abandoned this sort of scheme of this linear history. That there is an indeterminacy about the future. I think that's very important. So there is no sort of theory of history as such. And we've also lost touch with imaginations of what socialism could possibly be in this period. One of the virtues of having something called state socialism was that it presented itself as an alternative to capitalism. We don't have clear alternatives to capitalism. We have to then continually invent new understandings of what those alternatives may be, and we should work from the very concrete institutions that exist in our society, what Eric Wright calls real utopias.
And they are often, in his scheme, and my view too, often revolved around socializing the market and deepening democracy. Many of the movements of the last 3 years have been experimenting in different understandings of democracy. They are not so disseminated throughout the world, but they do give us ideas of what alternatives may be. That is the project today, is to think that capitalism does have an alternative. Yes, okay. Phew, that's enough. So, yes, that's a good way to end. The sociological Marxism, the right-hand column, has to deal today with the realities of a capitalism that is genuinely global and is very fluid and flows from place to place and combines a finance capital that we cannot quite comprehend, that we have to comprehend, with also the ecological crisis that becomes ever more imminent as time unfolds. And that we have to grasp the importance of the social, not just at the local and national, but also at the global level, to build a vision of a civil society of global dimensions. And that we have to also try to sustain imaginations of alternatives to capitalism based on not imaginary utopias, but real utopias that real people partake in. Things like, which look very social democratic and reformist, but nevertheless give imaginations of alternatives, whether it's cooperatives, whether it's participatory budgeting, whether it's universal income grants. These are ideas that we should be, in my view, engaging in discussing the conditions of their existence and dissemination. That is the sociological Marxism. And I'm sorry I've gone on a bit. Okay, I'll end there. Yes, thank you very much. That's like an orchestra. So, I'm here to answer questions, I hope. Yep. Or critiques or whatever. And by all means, ask your questions.